Hello. Welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thank you for tuning in. Today we will continue our reading of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. It was published in 1889, became an instant success, and has never been out of print. The book has been categorized as a comic travelogue, perhaps the first. As our musical touchstone to accompany this reading, we will use Peter Dawson's rendition of Old Father Thames, recorded in 1933. There will be 17 episodes in this presentation, read to you by Bruce Carlson. Please join me now for episode 16 of Three Men in a Boat.
He comes in quietly with his hat on, appropriates the most comfortable chair, lights his pipe, and commences to puff in silence. He lets the youngsters brag away for a while, and then during a momentary lull, he removes the pipe from his mouth and remarks as he knocks the ashes out against the bars, "Well, I had a haul on Tuesday evening that is not much good in my telling anybody about." "Oh, why's that?" they ask. "Because I don't expect anyone would believe me if I did," replies the old fellow calmly, and without even a tinge of bitterness in his tone as he refills his pipe. There is a pause after this, nobody feeling sufficiently sure of himself to contradict the old gentleman, so he has to go on by himself without any encouragement. "No," he continues thoughtfully, "I shouldn't believe it myself if anybody told it to me, but it's a fact for all that. I had been sitting there all afternoon and had caught literally nothing except a few dozen dace and a score of jack. I was just about giving it up as a bad job when I suddenly felt a rather smart pull at the line. I thought it was another little one, and I went to jerk it up. Hang me if I could move the rod. It took me half an hour, sir, to land that fish, and every moment I thought the line was going to snap. I reached him up at last, and what do you think it was? A sturgeon, a 40-pound sturgeon, taken on a line, sir. Yes, you may look well surprised." And then he goes on to tell of the astonishment of everybody who saw it, and what his wife said when he got home, and of what Joe Buggles thought about it. I asked the landlord of an inn up the river once if it did not injure him sometimes listening to the tales that fishermen are told to him. He said, "Oh, no, not now, sir. It did used to knock me over a bit at first, but me and the missus, we listen to them all day now. It's what you're used to, you know. It's what you're used to." I knew a young man once. He was a most conscientious fellow, and when he took to fly fishing, he determined never to exaggerate his hauls by more than, 25%. "When I have caught 40 fish," said he, "then I will tell people that I have caught 50. But I will not lie any more than that, because it is sinful to lie." But the 25% plan did not work well at all. He was never able to use it. The greatest number of fish he ever caught in one day was 3, and you can't add 25% to there, at least not in fish. So he increased his percentage to 33 1/3. But that, again, was awkward when he had only caught 1 or 2. So, to simplify matters, he made up his mind to just double the quantity. He stuck to this arrangement for a couple of months, and then he grew dissatisfied with it. Nobody believed him when he told them that he only doubled, and he, therefore, gained no credit that way whatever, while his moderation put him at a disadvantage among the other anglers. When he had really caught 3 small fish, and he said he had caught 6, it used to make him quite jealous to hear a man, whom he knew for a fact had only caught 1, going about telling people that he had landed 2 dozen. So eventually he made one final arrangement with himself, which he has religiously held ever since, and that was to count each fish that he had caught as 10, and to assume 10 to begin with. For example, if he did not catch any fish at all, then he said he had caught 10 fish. You could never catch less than 10 fish by his system. That was the foundation of it. Then, if by any chance he really did catch one fish, he called it 20. Well, two fish would count 30, 3, 40, and so on. It is a simple and easily worked plan, and there has been some talk lately of it being made use of by the angling fraternity in general. Indeed, the committee of the Thames Anglers Association did recommend its adoption about 2 years ago, but some of the older members opposed it. They said they would consider the idea if the number were doubled and each fish counted as 20. If ever you have an evening to spare up the river, I should advise you to drop into one of the little village inns and take a seat in the tap room. Old rodmen, sipping their toddy there, will tell you enough fishy stories in half an hour to give you indigestion for a month. George and I didn't know what had become of Harris. He had gone out and had a shave early in the afternoon, and had then come back and spent a full 40 minutes in pipe-claying his shoes. We had not seen him since. George and I, therefore, and the dog, left to ourselves, went for a walk to Wallingford on the second evening, and, coming home, we called in at a little riverside inn for a rest and other things. We went into the parlor and sat down. There was an old fellow there smoking a long clay pipe, and we naturally began chatting. He told us that it had been a fine day today, and we told him that it had been a fine day yesterday, and then we all told each other that we thought it would be a fine day tomorrow, and George said the crops seemed to be coming up nicely. After that, it came out somehow or other that we were strangers in the neighborhood, and that we were going away the next morning. Then a pause ensued in the conversation, during which our eyes wandered round the room. They finally rested upon a dusty old glass case, fixed very high up above the chimney-piece, and containing a trout. It rather fascinated me, that trout. It was such a monstrous fish. In fact, at first glance, I thought it was a cod. "Ah," said the old gentleman, following the direction of my gaze. "Fine fellow, that, aren't thee?" "Quite uncommon," I murmured, and George asked the old man how much he thought it weighed. 18 pounds 6 ounces, said our friend, rising and taking down his coat. "Yes," he continued, "it were 16 year ago, come the 3rd on next month, that I landed him. I caught him just below the bridge with a minnow. They told me he were in the river, and I said I'd have him, and so I did. You don't see many fish that size about here now, I'm thinking. Good night, gentlemen, good night." And out he went and left us alone. We could not take our eyes off the fish after that. It really was a remarkably fine fish. We were still looking at it when the local carrier, who had just stopped in at the inn, came to the door of the room with a pot of beer in his hand, and he also looked at the fish. "Good-sized trout, that," said George, turning round to him. "Ah, you may well say that, sir," replied the man, and then, after a pull at his beer, he added, "Maybe you wasn't here, sir, when the fish was caught." "No," we told him, "we were strangers in the neighborhood." "Ah," said the carrier then, "of course. Of course, how should you? It was nearly 5 years ago that I caught that trout." "Oh, was it you who caught it then?" said I. "Yes, sir," replied the genial old fellow. "I caught him just below the lock, leastways what was the lock then, one Friday afternoon. And the remarkable thing about it is that I caught him with a fly. I'd gone out pike fishing, bless you, never thinking of a trout. And when I saw that whopper on the end of my line, blessed if it didn't quite take me aback. Well, you see, he weighed 26 pounds. Good night, gentlemen, good night. 5 minutes afterwards, a third man came in, and he described how he had caught it early one morning with bleak. And then he left, and a stolid, solemn-looking, middle-aged individual came in and sat down over by the window. None of us spoke for a while, but at length George turned to the newcomer and said, "I beg your pardon. I hope you will forgive the liberty that we perfect strangers in the neighborhood are taking, but my friend here and myself would be so much obliged if you would tell us how you caught that trout up there." "Why, who told you I caught the trout?" was the surprised query. We said that nobody had told us so, but somehow or other we felt instinctively that it was he who had done it. "Well, it's a most remarkable thing, most remarkable," answered the stolid stranger, laughing, "because, as a matter of fact, you are quite right, I did catch it. But fancy your guessing it like that. Dear me, it really is a most remarkable thing." And then he went on and told us how it had taken him half an hour to land it, and how it had broken his rod. He said he had weighed it carefully when he reached home, and it had turned the scale at 34 pounds. He went in his turn, and when he was gone, the landlord came in to us. We told him the various histories we had heard about his trout, and he was immensely amused, and we all laughed very heartily. Fancy Jim Bates and Joe Muggles and Mr. Jones and old Billy Maunders all telling you that they had caught it. "Oh, ha, ha! Well, that is good," said the honest fellow, laughing heartily. "Yes, they are the sort to give it to me, to put up in my parlor if they had caught it, they are. Yeah, ha, ha." And then he told us the real story of the fish. It seems that he had caught it himself years ago when he was quite a lad, not by any art or skill, but by that unaccountable luck that appears to always wait upon a boy when he plays the wag from school and goes out fishing on a sunny afternoon with a bit of string tied on to the end of a tree. He said that bringing home that trout had saved him from a whacking, and that even his schoolmaster had said it was worth the rule of three and practice put together. He was called out of the room at this point, and George and I again turned our gaze upon the fish. It really was a most astonishing trout. The more we looked at it, the more we marveled at it. It excited George so much that he climbed up on the back of a chair to get a better view of it. And then the chair slipped, and George clutched wildly at the trout case to save himself, and down it came with a crash, George and the chair on top of it. "You haven't injured the fish, have you?" I cried in alarm, rushing up. "I hope not," said George, rising cautiously, looking about. But he had. That trout lay shattered into 1,000 fragments. I say 1,000, but they may have only been 900. I did not count them. We thought it strange and unaccountable that a stuffed trout should break up into little pieces like that. And so it would have been strange and unaccountable if it had been a stuffed trout. But it was not. That trout was made of plaster of Paris. Chapter 18. We left Streatley early the next morning and pulled up to Culham and slept under the canvas in the backwater there. The river is not extraordinarily interesting between Streatley and Wallingford. From Cleve you get a stretch of 6.5 miles without a lock. I believe this is the longest uninterrupted stretch anywhere above Teddington, and the Oxford Club makes use of it for their trial eights. But however satisfactory this absence of locks may be to rowing men, it is to be regretted by the mere pleasure seeker. For myself, I am fond of locks. They pleasantly break the monotony of pull. I like sitting in the boat and slowly rising out of the cool depths into new reaches and fresh views, or sinking down, as it were, out of the world, and then waiting while the gloomy gates creak and the narrow strip of daylight between them widens till a fair smiling river lies full before you, and you push your little boat out from its brief prison onto the welcoming waters once again. They are picturesque little spots, these locks. The stout old lock keeper, or his cheerful-looking wife or bright-eyed daughter, are pleasant folk to have a passing chat with. You meet other boats there, and the river gossip is exchanged. The Thames would not be the fairyland it is without its flower-decked locks. Talking of locks reminds me of an accident George and I very nearly had one summer morning at Hampton Court. It was a glorious day, and the lock was crowded, and, as is a common practice up the river, a speculative photographer was taking a picture of all of us as we lay upon the rising waters. I did not catch what was going on at first, and was, therefore, extremely surprised at noticing George hurriedly smoothing out his trousers, ruffle up his hair, and stick his cap on in a rakish manner at the back of his head, and then, assuming an expression of mingled affability and sadness, sat down in a graceful attitude and tried to hide his feet. My first idea was that he had suddenly caught sight of some girl he knew, and I looked about to see who it was. Everybody in the lock seemed to have been suddenly struck wooden. They were all standing or sitting about in the most quaint and curious attitudes I have ever seen off a Japanese fan. All the girls were smiling. Oh, they did look so sweet. And all the fellows were frowning and looking stern and noble. And then, at last, the truth flashed across me, and I wondered if I should be in time. Ours was the first boat, and it would be unkind of me to spoil the man's picture, I thought. So I faced around quickly and took up my position in the prow, where I leant with careless grace upon the hitcher in an attitude suggestive of agility and strength. I arranged my hair with a curl over the forehead and threw an air of tender wistfulness on my expression, mingled with a touch of cynicism, which I am told suits me. As we stood waiting for the eventful moment, I heard someone behind call out, "Hi, look at your nose!" I could not turn around to see what was the matter and whose nose it was that was to be looked at. I stole a side glance at George's nose. It was all right. At all events, there was nothing wrong with it that could be altered. I squinted down at my own, and that seemed all right also. "Look at your nose, you stupid ass," came the voice again, louder. And then another cried, "Push your nose out, can't you? You too with the dog." Neither George nor I dared to turn around. The man's hand was on the cap, and the picture might be taken at any moment. Was it us they were calling to? What was the matter with our noses? Why were they to be pushed out? But now the whole lock started yelling, and a stentorian voice from the back shouted, "Look to your boat, sir, you in the red and black caps. It's your two corpses that will get taken in that photo if you aren't quick." We looked then and saw that the nose of our boat had got fixed under the woodwork of the lock. While the incoming water was rising all around it and tilting it up, in another instant we should be over. Quick as thought, we each seized an oar and a vigorous blow against the side of the lock with the butt ends released the boat and sent us sprawling on our backs. We did not come out well in that photograph, George and I. Of course, as was to be expected, our luck ordained it that the man should set his wretched machine in motion at the precise moment that we were both lying on our backs with a wild expression of, "Where am I?" and "What is it?" on our faces, and our 4 feet waving madly in the air. Our feet were undoubtedly the leading article in that photograph. Indeed, very little else was to be seen. They filled up the foreground entirely. Behind them you caught glimpses of the other boats and bits of the surrounding scenery, but everything and everybody else in the lock looked utterly insignificant and paltry compared to our feet. That all the other people felt quite ashamed of themselves and refused to subscribe to the picture. The owner of one steam launch, who had bespoke 4 copies, rescinded the order on seeing the negative. He said he would take them if anybody could show him his launch, but nobody could. It was somewhere behind George's right foot. There was a good deal of unpleasantness over the business. The photographer thought we ought to take 12 copies each, seeing the photo was about 9/10 us, but we declined. We said we had no objection to being photo full length, but we preferred being taken the right way up. Wallingford, 6 miles above Streatley, is a very ancient town, and has been an active center for the making of English history. It was a rude, mud-built town in the time of the Britons who squatted there, until the Roman legions evicted them, and replaced their clay-banked walls by mighty fortifications, the trace of which time has not yet succeeded in sweeping away. So well those old-world masons knew how to build. But time, though he halted at Roman walls, soon crumbled Romans to dust, and on the ground in later years fought Saxons and huge Danes until the Normans came. It was a walled and fortified town up to the time of the Parliamentary War, when it suffered a long and bitter siege from Fairfax. It fell at last, and then the walls were raised. From Wallingford up to Dorchester, the neighborhood of the river grows more hilly, varied, and picturesque. Dorchester stands 1/2 mile from the river. It can be reached by paddling up the Thames, if you have a small boat, but the best way is to leave the river at Dayslock and take a walk across the fields. Dorchester, like Wallingford, was a city in ancient British times, and it was then called Caerdoran, the city on the water. In more recent times, the Romans formed a great camp here, the fortifications surrounding which now seem like low, even hills. In Saxon days, it was the capital of Wessex. It is very old, and it was very strong and great once. Now it sits aside from the stirring world and nods and dreams. Round Clifton Hampden, itself a wonderfully pretty village, old-fashioned, peaceful, and dainty with flowers, the river scenery is rich and beautiful. If you stay the night on land at Clifton, you cannot do better than to put up at the Barley Mow. It is, without exception, I should say, the quaintest, most old-world inn up the river. It stands on the right of the bridge, quite away from the village. Its low-pitched gables and thatched roof and latticed windows give it a storybook appearance, while inside is even still more once-upon-a-time-fied. It would not be a good place for the heroine of a modern novel to stay at. The heroine of a modern novel is always divinely tall, and she is ever drawing herself up to her full height. At the Barley Mow, she would bump her head against the ceiling each time she did this. It would also be a bad house for a drunken man to put up at. There are too many surprises in the way of unexpected steps down to his room and up into that, and as for getting upstairs to his bedroom or ever finding his bed when he got up, either operation would be an utter impossibility to him. We were up early the next morning, as we wanted to be in Oxford by afternoon. It is surprising how early one can get up when camping out. One does not yearn for just another 5 minutes nearly so much, lying wrapped up in a rug on the boards of a boat with a Gladstone bag for a pillow as one does in a feather bed. We had finished breakfast and were through Clifton Lock by 8:30. From Clifton to Culham, the river banks are flat, monotonous, and uninteresting. But after you get through Culham Lock, the coldest and deepest lock on the river, the landscape improves. At Abingdon, the river passes by the streets. Abingdon is a typical country town of the smaller order, quiet, eminently respectable, clean, desperately dull. It prides itself on being old, but whether it can compare in this respect with Wallingford and Dorchester seems doubtful. A famous abbey stood here once, and within what is left of its sanctified walls, they brew bitter ale nowadays. St. Nicholas Church at Abingdon, there is a monument to John Blackwell and his wife Jane, who both, after leading a happy married life, died on the very same day, August 21, 1625. And in St. Helen's Church it is recorded that W. Lee, who died in 1637, five times mayor of Abingdon, was no doubt a benefactor to his generation. From Abingdon to Nuneham Courtney is a lovely stretch. Nuneham Park is well worth a visit. It can be viewed on Tuesdays and Thursdays. The house contains a fine collection of pictures and curiosities. The grounds are very beautiful. The pool under Sanford Lasher, just behind the lock, is a very good place to drown yourself in. The undercurrent is terribly strong, and if you once get down into it, you are all right. An oblique marks the spot where two men have already been drowned while bathing there, and the steps of the oblique is generally used as a diving board by young men now who wish to see if the place really is dangerous.
You have been listening to episode 16 of Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. Please remember that if you miss an episode, you can find it by going to our website, ktwh.org, and clicking on Programs, and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each week, we will post the episodes from the prior 2 weeks for you to catch up on. Please join me next time for the final episode of Three Men in a Boat, here on Literally from the North Shore. Old Father Thames keeps rolling along down to the mighty sea. What does he know? What does he care? Nothing for you or me. Old Father Thames keeps rolling along down to the mighty sea. He never seems to worry, doesn't care for fortune's fate.